Hello, I'm Sahel Mirza, and welcome to this episode of Voices of Care. My guest today is Professor Geeta Menon, Chair of the British Association of Physicians of Indian Origin, BAPIO's Grand Advisory Council. Geeta, welcome to Voices of Care. Thank you for making the time to join us here.
Thank you, Sahel, for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
It's a privilege to have you here, Geeta. I wanted to start, firstly, before we look at your career and some of the key lessons that medical professionals can learn from this, to look at the work of BAPIO. You're the chair of the Grand Advisory Council. Can you tell us a little bit about BAPIO? It's been around nearly 30 years, I think, and obviously has a very wide mission for physicians of Indian origin and beyond.
Yeah. No. So BAPIO, like you said, has been here for the last 27 years now, and it has been very much that organization that supports international medical graduates that come into this country. They kind of look after them, try to make sure that they have always tried to address differential attainment, which is, as you can imagine, a big issue amongst our international medical graduates. And their mission and vision has always been, you know, trying to make sure that their members are supported. I just happened to be the first woman chair in the last 25 years. So, because I took over last year.
No, well, congratulations very belatedly on that. It's a wonderful accolade. Now, one of BAPIO's objectives is for its members to realise their potential as leaders and in terms of professional excellence. And I know that you're a humble individual, but I think you match that criteria in realising your potential. So many things that you've done. I'd like to just step on this journey, if I may. You've always wanted to, I think, be a doctor from a young age. Ahmedabad Medical School, I think, is where the journey began.
That's right. So when I was a little girl, we used to have our family physician. In those days, they would come home if you were really ill. And so Dr. Pandit used to come home, and it was miracle. Like, he'd walk in there and, you know, give you a little pat on your shoulder and give you the medication, and you were well the next day. And I used to think, that's what I want to be. I mean, you know, he just comes in and does everything. And so I've always wanted to be a doctor from a very young age. And I was really lucky to actually get into a medical school in Ahmedabad, which is where I lived and, you know, did my school education as well. And so I started my journey in medicine in that place. My family is not of doctors, so I'm the first doctor in our family, you could say. There are no doctors in our family. And
the genes have continued, just briefly, of your son has followed the footsteps as a radiologist, I believe. So you've started a trend in the family.
I don't know. My younger brother is also a surgeon. He's a transplant surgeon, liver transplant surgeon. And yeah. But yeah, so that's what I always wanted to do. And
you specialised, you're a consultant ophthalmic surgeon at Frimley Healthcare. Now, you've done a number of different things. That's your work as a consultant. But just very briefly, you've always had a passion for education and for research.
Yeah. So I think I've had a very circuitous journey, we could say. So started at Frimley as what was called a middle grade doctor, a specialty doctor, and then went on to do what was equivalence training to recognize all my training in India to become go on to the specialist register, and then they created a consultant post for me there. So, but I've always been passionate about education, even in my training days. And so that was something that I always wanted to actually do. Then I was told that, you know, oh, you can't do both. You can't do training and, you know, be a chief of service as well as do research. And these are my passions. And so I just did them because I was allowed to do them, and I never regretted it.
And I think there's perhaps a lesson there about courage and courage of your conviction, staying outside of comfort zones.
Yeah. So I think I always believe in this mantra that you should always choose courage over comfort. And I love Brené Brown, you know, where she says that if you are comfortable, then you're not being brave enough. So I think choosing courage over comfort is sometimes very difficult, because you have to make difficult decisions, like the decision I made when I had thought I was living the dream in India, and then the middle of my career decided to come out and come into the UK. And it was interesting because I was there as a vitreoretinal consultant, and then the next month I was here as a senior house officer in Luton.
Well, I want to expand on that journey, if I may, because it takes us to an important topic about international medical graduates. They're an important cohort here in the NHS. The General Medical Council's workforce report in 2023 stated that actually it was vital for the UK to attract international medical graduates and improve their retention, etc. 52% of people that joined the medical workforce in 2022 are international medical graduates. I want to come back to their role and how we can support their attention. But going back to your journey, moving from India to here, I think you were inspired by a professor in India who had been over here on a Commonwealth fellowship. But when you came here, it wasn't plain sailing. There were some practical things you had to just adjust to a brand new country, even though you'd read lots about England.
That's correct. So I came on my own. So that was my first stint into coming outside India on my own. I left my son and my husband because my husband needed to do a lot more paperwork because he was in a government job. And I remember landing here in the autumn. It was September 28th, to be exact. And suddenly, after having lived a totally sheltered life, I'm ashamed to say, in India, where you had everything handed on to you, you didn't have to do anything, you know, you had a chauffeur, you had, you know, a maid, you had, and here you suddenly had to come in, find a house to rent, you had to actually start a bank account, which I had never done in my entire life. And it was quite an interesting experience, and I'll never forget that first meeting I had with the person I was going to rent the house from, who was an Italian hairdresser, and he came with his son, and they kind of looked like the mafiosi with their video camera, and they were videoing the house, and I was thinking, why have they brought this camera with them? Not realizing that they were videoing the house to make sure that when I hand the house back, it should be in that perfect order, otherwise they were going to take my deposit away.
Absolutely.
So it was the naivety of the situation. When you look back on it, you think, oh my God, I need to make sure that none of the people who come here actually have to go through that. And it was hard because, you know, my son was in India. We didn't have mobile phones in those days. So
this was 1995, I think.
Yes,
nearly 30 years now.
Yeah, 30 years. And, you know, you had to go to the payphone with the pound coins and keep putting them in. And you could see them disappearing and thinking, okay, this is the last one. I don't have any more. And you know, you used to be really worried about what are you going to do, how are you going to do it. But you know what? You had made that decision. And that's where the courage comes in.
Yeah.
You had made the decision. You had taken that step to come into this country because you thought you wanted to learn. You wanted to actually expand your knowledge. And I don't regret any of those decisions, despite all the trials and tribulations and some of the things we had to go through. Because in a month's time, my son and husband were here and, you know,
life started.
Yes.
So if we can jump from the practical of using the payphone and how to open a bank account to the professional and a serious point. We talked about the GMC saying it's, look, even though the long-term workforce plan, which came out in January 2023, is going to see hopefully a huge increase in the number of doctors qualified here, all the demographics and projections show that internationally medical graduates will be over a third at least of the workforce, approximately, even in 2036. So this is an important cohort of individuals. Turning to the professional journey, you were a consultant and you had to take a junior role for which you were overqualified. So there's quite a few lessons that we need to learn about how we truly honour international medical graduates and their level of seniority.
Yeah, I think we do that better now.
Yeah.
But this was because, you know, in those days, there was only a fixed way in which you could come, which was a double sponsorship scheme where you were sponsored by somebody in India to a consultant here. And then the Royal College sponsored you to get PLAB exemption. So you didn't need to do the PLAB test. Things have changed. But we could still do things better. Yeah. I mean, there's always room for improvement. And it's a journey. And I'm lucky that now I am in charge of, in my new role in NHS England, I am in charge of international medical graduates. So I am going to be able to make that difference, I hope.
Absolutely. That, and that space. Because we have to address the differential attainment and all of these type of things to get the best out of the individual and to retain, because retention is going to be vital, and that's fundamentally about the humanity with which we treat individuals, but also giving them career pathways that honour their success.
Yeah, and that's why we now have different schemes that we're starting where people are being trained in their home country after recognizing what the gap is in what has been, what they would have been taught here to what they need to be learning. And then that brings them at the same level as other individuals before they come here. So they're not, and then, you know, trying to value them, make them feel that they belong to this place. And that's, you know, just not that difficult. It just needs that cultural change.
It shouldn't be. Yeah. It shouldn't be that difficult. Yeah. No, but I think, well, it'll be interesting to hear how your new role with NHS England pans out. We'd love to hear that in due course. Broadening this whole issue around inclusion, because this is really under that topic, you've been on record as saying that it's important for a woman like you to have a voice. And I think being a female leader, doctor, educator, researcher, has brought many opportunities, but interesting challenges along the way. I wanted you to sort of expand perhaps some of the lessons for other female doctors that are either in their career or thinking about this pathway. It's not been plain sailing. Even back in India, I think when you wanted to become a retinal surgeon, there were only a few females at the time, and you were trying to be guided away from that. Is that not right?
Yes. So it started with ophthalmology, actually. Mm. They were like, oh, you know, doing ophthalmology for a female is a very difficult thing. Mm. You know, you just need to do pediatrics. I think that's much easier. You can actually sit in a consulting room and you don't need to worry. But I must say that I get my drive from my mother. Mm-hmm. And I get my dad gave me my dreams. Mm-hmm. He let me dream big, and being a female was nothing. I mean, you know, you could do what you wanted. And when I said, no, I do want to do ophthalmology, I was in my second year of medical school when I decided that's what I wanted to do. And he said, go ahead and do it. Why do you want to listen to all these people? That's what you want to do, do it. Similarly, when I came into Kerala after I got married from Gujarat, we had a real problem with retinal detachments that were coming there. Patients did not have anybody to actually, you know, do the surgery. So I went back to Ahmedabad to actually do retinal training as a retinal surgeon, as a vitreoretinal surgeon. And over there, it was interesting because it's very, very much was a male-dominated profession at that time. I was told, why are you actually doing all this? You got an 18-month-old child. They decided that I wouldn't actually come in for the ward rounds and do my bit of the work because I was the only female in that gang of four fellows that were doing the fellowship. And they said, go and do oculopathology. And I was like, no. This is what I want to do. And I will come and show you that even if I have an 18-month-old child, I will still be delivering on all the things that I need to do. And I feel very strongly that, you know, when you should not listen to the naysayers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If
absolutely.
You have the grit, if you've got the passion and perseverance for something that you want to do it, don't listen to the naysayers. Just actually show them with your actions. That's what I would say.
And we are here today with all of the things that you've achieved. And I guess that lesson is alive even today because we've come a long way in terms of gender equality, etc. But there is still sometimes stereotypes.
It was a little bit shocking. Then I come here, you know, and 10, how many years? And 2011, I became the postgraduate. No, 2014 became postgraduate in 18. And I had my surgical trainees come, foundation trainees come and tell me how they were being treated in the surgical wards.
In 2014?
In 2018, actually.
When you were postgraduate dean at Health Education England.
In South London. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, so things really need to change. You still have that thing of monopoly saying that, oh, you know, you're a female, you can't be trauma in orthopedics, you know, you're too petite. Yeah, that's not what it means.
No, absolutely not. Well, again, it'll be interesting to see how in your role with NHS England that you drive that by example. And I think there's a similar lesson here. I want to talk, if I may, in the next segment about health education and research, because these have been such passionate subjects for you. Medical education, you were Directorate of Medical Education and became head of the School of Ophthalmology in Kent, Surrey and Sussex. And I just want to stop there for a second before we talk about the importance of education itself. There were some eyebrows raised when you became head of the School of Ophthalmology relating to the fact that you weren't trained in this country.
Yeah, so basically, when they heard that I had been asked to apply and set up the School of Ophthalmology in KS, Kent, Surrey and Sussex, there were these groups of individuals who felt that I wouldn't know what to do because I actually had not trained here. So how would I know how to set up a School of Ophthalmology and let alone develop a curriculum to deliver training to these trainees? But like I said, I get that drive and from my mom and that resilience as well. And I just actually decided, okay, I know I can do it. If it was something that I thought I wasn't going to be able to do it, I wouldn't even have applied for it. Mm. I went ahead and it's interesting that things that I developed in my school were then taken over nationally by the college, you know, the induction program, etc. So,
which people benefit from today. So I guess one of the lessons for me there is, however we define success, it's about an acceptance of ourselves.
Yeah, I think I love Maya Angelou and I love some of her quotes. And she says, success is liking yourself, liking what you do and liking how you do it.
Absolutely. Well, I think you're walking that talk. Moving just broadly onto the role of medical education, I just briefly wanted to touch upon we've had the budget in 2024, the government committing billions of extra pounds to technology in a variety of different ways. Now, technology has been around for a long time. There's been lots and lots of talk about AI and all sorts of things. But bringing it down to earth, as a physician, the role of technology in education, this is going to be fundamental and it will transform, I think, the way medicine is taught and actually delivered.
Yeah, and it's not just the training and education, it's also the way healthcare will be delivered will change as well. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is to look at how do we train our next generation healthcare professionals to actually take in that digitalization, the technology, etc., into it. And it was interesting, we just came back from India and India has adopted it wholeheartedly, which was really interesting because what you would have thought was in a developing country, it would have been very difficult to actually get technology to the masses. But interestingly, you know, everyone has a mobile phone, everyone has a smartphone. So how do you actually get to, you know, get your education, your technology, your healthcare, everything on that, on different apps?
So they've grasped that.
Yeah.
So it's a mindset issue.
Yes, exactly.
And I guess whether you're a nurse, an allied health professional, a doctor, the way that training now needs to be delivered needs to also be digitized and be disruptive.
Yeah, correct. And I think that there's quite a bit of this happening already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, clearly technology has moved leaps and bounds. And like I said, in the delivery of healthcare as well, in my own specialty, if you look at it, my special interest is medical retina. Mm-hmm. And we do diabetic retinopathy screening. And artificial intelligence has actually been used to, you know, grade the images and help with the care of the patients. So, you know, that has actually, you know, kind of speeded up the way we can treat patients these days.
So plenty of promise there. Yeah. In the future. Just as it's not an adjunct, it's parallel, one of your many paths in your professional career, going on to research. Now, people don't normally do education and do the as a researcher. You were elected to the Royal College of Physicians and I think won an award in 2016 with the RCP and the National Institute of Health Research for your research. But this has been a passion from a young age, I believe, back in India and also when you were here in Moorfields.
Yeah, so basically Research has always been something, another one of my passions, like education. And it was allowed to grow when I was in Kerala, when I was working in Kerala. And I actually, again, there changed the norm, because people always in Kerala believe you should have a government job. And I said, no, I won't work in this private hospital. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, but then you won't get any research and things done. And they were wrong, because we did do a lot of research, and I won quite a few awards in trying to, you know, get indigenous suture materials made, etc. And so when I came into this country, I just felt I didn't want to, give up on it. So I was living in Luton at that time, and I was put in touch with this professor at Moorfields, and he said to me, oh, if you can come one day a week to Moorfields, I can, you know, set you up on a project, etc. And so I remember going one day a week all the way from Luton to Moorfields and, working really hard on this project. And so it really helped me keep that research in. So as I then went off to Frimley and then became a consultant, I wanted to keep that personal research. And
you established the research unit.
Yes, I established the research unit there in ophthalmology. And for many years, we were the top, research, delivering the research in Frimley for compared to other specialties. Ophthalmology was the top. And I think it helped me actually bring in young researchers that really it was, and you know, people who used to come, say, for example, doctors, their wives would be coming with them. Their doctor wives were qualified. They were not doctors, but they were qualified in various bits, you see. So we used to bring them in and make them research assistants and train them, work in the NHS so that they could then go on and get jobs elsewhere.
That also embedded the whole family of
retention again. As well. Yeah.
I guess today's podcast has been one filled with many lessons, and we're going to come on to the final question in a moment. But I guess the lesson here is, or the advice is, to a young or any doctor, that don't be siloed. If you have a passion, you can pursue it.
Yeah, because I do feel that education and research do go together. Mm-hmm. And I do feel that, you know, the younger researchers, we need to get more of them in the field. And the way you do it is through education. And it's really something very important, very close to my heart. So as the clinical director for Kensari and Sussex NIHR, the clinical research network, I feel that we've done quite a bit in trying to get more people into research.
Absolutely, and let the conveyor belt continue. I'd like to finish off with another one of your passions, and this is the importance of leadership. We're in a place of tremendous transformation here in England, and indeed the world, the place where care is delivered, the way in which it's delivered, will require new forms of leadership. The Messenger Review in 2022 highlighted many areas where that needs to change. I wanted to hone in on the work that you've been doing, what you have been doing with supporting leadership, particularly with the view to this technological transformation, multidisciplinary teams. It's going to require a different type of leadership skill set, isn't it, to be able to navigate this change?
Yeah, so I wish I had known all this when I started in my career, you see. You go and do a lot of leadership courses. But I must say that I learned most of my leadership skills from my ex-chief exec, Sir Andrew Morris. Mm. He's an amazing leader. And I've learned quite a few things from where I have seen him actually do things. But after a lot of leadership courses, when I became postgraduate dean in 2018, I was asked about what is your, you know, personal development that you want to do. And they suggested, do you want to go on this Howard Massey Institute course, which is leading innovations in healthcare and education. Mm. And so I said, okay. And so I went on this course. And for the first time, it kind of, you know, rang the bell for me, because it was using the practicalities of leadership. It was actually bringing in the Harvard business model into how do you deliver it in education and healthcare. And so on the plane journey back with two of my colleagues, I said, we need to develop something like this for our trainees. And so they were like, oh my God, here she goes again. And then we actually developed what is called Leading Through Education to Excellent Patient Care, which is LEAP.
Yeah.
And we not only delivered that, so it's a series of four webinars, which is developing self, developing teams, change management, and system leadership. And we've been delivering it not just for doctors, trainees, etc., but also for other healthcare professionals. And the best bit about the sustainability of the program is if you've come and done the webinars, then you can become faculty and you can deliver the same. And we've got this whole model. Yeah, yeah. So it's that's how we get the faculty. And so we've got a huge like alumni now, people who've done the course and who are doing the course, teaching others. So you're always in that space of spiral learning of leadership, you know. And I think that really resonates with all the different things you need in this healthcare setting at the moment. So we're doing this accelerated community diagnostic center program at the moment, where we've done international recruitment for radiographers, radiologists, and echocardiographers. And I'm delivering LEAP to the radiographers at the moment. In fact, next week we have our second cohort. And it's really interesting because nobody has actually taught them any leadership skills before. So.
And it's going to be needed because it's not if you're a head of department, it's in whatever role
exactly
you need to do that. And just a couple of very quick points because I'm conscious that this is a very deep topic, but I think you highlight in particular in terms of being able to have systems literacy and also the value of compassion. As part of being a leader, so that there's psychological safety for the people that you lead.
Yeah, so that's very much the thread, the golden thread that runs through our leadership program. It's about the humility, the authenticity of being a leader. We're telling those people who have come from other countries that you don't need to change yourself. So what if you don't know anything about football? Well, you're an Indian, you know anything about the cricket, teach them about that, you know. Don't change yourself, don't cover up. And second thing is that, you know, making sure that your team feels safe to come and tell you about their mistakes and misses. Because I think the worst thing would be for me if my team member did not come to me, but I hear from a third person about something that has happened. So yeah, so I think, but it's a journey, it's a changing culture, takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think if we sit back and say, oh, it's too difficult to change culture, it'll never happen. So for me, whatever little you can do, we must start the journey. And we've also developed this cultural safety workshop as well, which the first of it we're delivering on Thursday.
I think that's going to be really important because obviously the cultural change in the NHS, NHS Staff Survey 2023, has shown some improvement, but there's many areas that we do improve. One last thing to leave with you, there's so many things you've achieved. I know you were taught very early to be humble, but it's inspiring to hear all of these things. And you've shared a few lessons with us. Are there one or two at the end that you want to perhaps share with us? I think kindness seems to be another golden thread that runs through all the work you've done.
Yeah, I think being kind and valuing people is really important. And Sohail, I feel sometimes people don't stop to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They make assumptions about people. And, you know, and people, you know, like Maya Angelou says, you know, they'll never forget how you made them feel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. The second lesson that I tell myself is that to live in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a workaholic. I love work. And so living in the moment is really important as well, because very soon that moment will become a memory and then you have to relive the memory, which is not that much fun. And so I've learned to do that as well. And that has been a learning experience for me to try and get that in my, you know, in not actually thinking about the next thing that I'm doing whilst I'm doing something else. And my grandchildren have taught me that.
Well, they're all valuable lessons for all of us as a society and as medical professionals and as healthcare professionals. On that note, Professor Geeta Menon, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us.
Thank you very much, Sohail, for inviting me.
It's been our privilege.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Voices of Care, please like, follow or subscribe wherever you receive your podcasts. And if you want to find out more about how we are transforming health and social care, please visit newcrosshealthcare.com/voices of care. In the meantime, I'm Sohail Mirza. Thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.